If you would, please turn to Luke chapter 5. You see in your bulletins there, we're going to be in the first 11 verses there in that chapter. If you have one of our guest Bibles, which by the way, if you don't own a Bible, you're welcome to take one of those and keep those. It's yours to keep here from the church. It is the New Living Translation, which is the version that I preach from about 95% of the time. And feel free to grab one of those and keep it if you want. And if you have one, we're going to be on page 825 this morning here in Luke chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. One day as Jesus was preaching on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, great crowds pressed in on him to listen to the word of God. He noticed two empty boats at the water's edge, for the fishermen had left them and were washing their nets. Stepping into one of the boats, Jesus asked Simon, its owner, to push it out into the water. So he sat in the boat and taught the crowds from there. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Now go out where it is deeper and let down your nets to catch some fish." "Master," Simon replied, "we worked hard all last night and didn't catch a thing. But if you say so, I'll let down the nets again." And this time, their nets were so full of fish, they began to tear. A shout for help brought their partners in the other boat, and soon both boats were filled with fish and on the verge of sinking. When Simon Peter realized what had happened, he fell to his knees before Jesus and said, "Oh Lord, please leave me. I'm such a sinful man." For he was awestruck by the number of fish they had caught, as were the others with him. His partners, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, were also amazed. Jesus replied to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on, you will be fishing for people." And as soon as they landed, they left everything and followed Jesus. Now, like you, most of you, if not, I hope all of you, I've been reading through the Daniel Lenten devotional that Pastor Aaron has produced for us over the last number of weeks, and the second part we began this week, and if you remember from the introduction, Pastor Aaron explained and laid out for us how Daniel chapters 2 through 7 are arranged in what is called a chiastic structure, or a chiasm. Now, a chiasm, of course, is a literary device where words and concepts are stated, but then they're repeated in reverse order. We saw a bit of that last week when we were in the passage where Jesus is in the synagogue, and Luke tells us he stands up, he's handed the scroll, it's unrolled, and he reads it. And then he rolls it back up, he hands it back to the attendant, and then he sits back down. You can see the structure there, this technique that's used to focus the reader's attention in on a particular climax or central point of the story. And the same thing is at work here in our text this morning. The climax of the text is not at the end of the narrative, but right in the center. And I've asked the good AV people up there if they would put up some slides here for us so you can see the chiastic structure here of our passage. It begins there in verse 3 where it says, Jesus gets on the boat and he goes out to teach. Verse 4, Jesus tells Simon to catch fish. Verse 5, Simon responds in defense. Then verses 6 and 7, which is sort of the climax here in our chiasm, you have this miraculous catch there in verses 6 and 7. But now watch the reverse order of things as they're stated here by Luke. Simon then responds in verses 8 and 9 in contrition. Verse 10, Jesus tells Simon to catch people. And then verse 11, the boat returns and the disciples follow Jesus. You see, I tried to color code it so it's clear how the parallel thoughts all kind of go together. You have what goes before the moment, then you have the moment, and then you have what follows the moment as a result. So I want to follow Luke's structure here this morning. I don't want to start here and look at all that preceded this miraculous catch there in verses 6 and 7. Now, if we went back to chapter 4, we would see that following the story where we were in last week, where Jesus was back in his hometown there in Nazareth, and he was basically run out of town, you'll see for the rest of the chapter, though, that Jesus has a dynamic ministry in and around the area, the region of Capernaum. And as he's ministering, we're told that his ministry has generated lots of interest, and there have been a lot of crowds that have been kind of following him around. And here, in chapter 5, we see that the crowds have pressed in on him in such a way that he finds himself on the seashore surrounded by this great multitude of people. Now, no one knows the exact location there in that region where this happened. There is a place near Capernaum where the land sort of has a gentle slope down to the seashore, and there's sort of a natural bay, and it forms something kind of like an amphitheater, right? So you have, you know, Jesus out on the water, and then he's facing the crowds on the land, and there have even been scientists who have done studies and measurements, and they say that it's very, it's entirely possible that a person could speak there, and thousands of people could hear them just because of the natural acoustics of the area. And that's what's going on there. Jesus sets out on the boat so that the multitude can see him and hear him clearly. Now, there also happened to be, as he gets to the seashore and he takes in the situation, he sees there on the shore a couple of empty boats there that we read about just a moment ago. And Luke says, and I love this little detail here in his text, he says there in the beginning of verse 2, he noticed them. Jesus noticed the boats. Now, that might seem like just some sort of trivial thing that we read over, like so much of the scriptures we treat as trivial. We treat as just sort of, it's there. It's not the important thing, so I skip over it. And I hope you sense, as we've been working through Luke, that nothing in Luke, and well, really nothing in all of the scriptures, but especially here in Luke, nothing is just for trivial sake. Nothing is just there because. It all serves a purpose. It all has meaning. And I think this statement here in verse 2, that Jesus noticed these boats as he was taking in the situation, I believe it is a key component in the progression of this narrative. It's amazing to me when we look at the scriptures and we look at our own experience from our lives, just how very different the Lord's perspective on things is from our own. How he sees our circumstances in such a different way than so often we do. What we see as random or insignificant to the Lord often is that which is most filled with potential. It is that thing that has value. When no one else sees the value, the Lord sees the value. He looks into the emptiness and the hopelessness and the dead-end situations of life, and he sees them as brand new opportunities or possibilities. The Lord has tremendous perspective that you and I don't have. And he is in the business of taking those things which are common and ordinary and using them for the extraordinary. And as the owners of these boats, these otherwise insignificant background characters, as they're on the sidelines washing the silt and the weeds from their empty nets, Luke tells us Jesus notices. Jesus notices. And he takes action. And so in verse 3, he steps into the boat. Don't you love Jesus' sort of just presumption here? I mean, it doesn't say that he was invited into the boat. It doesn't say that he asked permission to get in the boat. Jesus just helps himself to the empty boat and asks that the boat would be put out into the water. And then after he's taught for a while, he asked Peter, or Simon at this point in the narrative, to put the nets down in the water to catch some fish. Now, can you put yourself in the story so far? Can you try to imagine what it was like for Simon in that moment when all these things were happening? I mean, Jesus has just commandeered his boat. Now, I know that there's cultural things at work here, that's their situation is very different than our own, but, I mean, imagine today if you're the owner of a boat and some random guy, even if he's not random, even someone that has some notoriety, a public person, just anybody in general who was not invited onto your boat, just helps himself onto it. I mean, I can feel sort of the sweat forming on the back of Simon's neck as he starts to feel that sort of mixture of irritation maybe, or inconvenience, or maybe embarrassment. I mean, after all, there's a great multitude here. Suddenly, he's now the center of the attention. You know, a moment ago, the boats are just, they're background things. They're just accessories to the scene. And now suddenly, they're right in the center. All eyes are now on Simon. What's he going to do? Jesus has asked to put the boat out. You can't say no, can you? You don't have much of a choice. And after all, Jesus did just heal your mother-in-law, Simon, back in chapter 4. I mean, you kind of owe him, don't you? I mean, when someone does you a solid like that, I mean, you don't tell him no the next second that he asks for something as simple as this. It would have been rude. But then Jesus goes from the presumptuous to, well, what comes across as downright insulting. Because it's one thing to say, I would like to borrow your boat that you're not using so that I can put out a little bit and take advantage of the natural acoustics of this beautiful scenery so that the crowd can hear me teach. But it's quite another thing to say, hey, let's go out and do some more fishing. And you can hear Simon's protest. Look again there in the beginning of verse 5. Master, Simon replied, we worked hard all last night. We've been out all night when the fish actually are there. And we didn't catch a single thing. I mean, what you're asking here, well, it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, with all due respect, Jesus, I know fishing. I mean, the first request, Jesus, made some sense. I get it. But this almost feels personal. And you can't really blame him, can you? I mean, what else would you expect to go through the mind of a professional fisherman in a bad mood when a non-fisherman orders him to do again in bad conditions what he has already tried to do and failed at doing in good conditions? But all of this, of course, has purpose behind. All of this is intentional. All of this was in Jesus' mind when he initiated the contact. And that, I cannot emphasize that enough. That it is Jesus here who is initiating the contact. It is Jesus here who has something else in mind. You cannot read the story and miss the fact that Jesus has greater things in mind for Simon's life. Nothing here is coincidental. Nothing here is accident. Everything here is purposeful. And you get this feeling that as Jesus is in the situation, he's taking in the situation, in the midst of all this crowd, his eyes are laser focused on one person. One person. Growing up, my grandparents lived in a house in central Ohio that was sort of the de facto home base for my family. All the rest of us, my parents and my siblings and I, we all kind of moved around a lot, but my grandparents were at that house on Graham Drive for decades. And I loved that house, and I missed that house. But there's one thing I don't miss in that house, and that was the painting of Jesus that was in my Uncle Craig's bedroom. Yes. The ubiquitous gaze of Jesus. Those pursuing eyes. Like you can either try to dodge. You could not dodge the gaze of Jesus. Because when you walked in that room, he was looking at you. No matter where you were, his eyes would follow you in that room. It was amazing to me. Drove me kind of crazy. But you know what? Every person, all joking aside, who has ever turned to look at Jesus in the face with the eyes of faith has discovered that he was already looking at them. You don't have to do all the stuff to get his attention. He's already looking at you. And he's been looking at you. And he will continue to look at you, even as you look at everything else that seems in the world. And you get this feeling here that Jesus is laser focused on this man. This man who'd spent all night out toiling and laboring and coming up with nothing but empty nets. And here's this guy that shows up and he's got a plan in mind for him. Is that not what the Lord declares through the prophet Jeremiah? I know the plans I have for you. They're in my mind. They're in my heart. Yes, in his sovereignty, God has control over all things. There's no question about it. But also in his providence, he permits other wills to coexist with his own. There's the permissive will of God that enables freedom. You can choose to do this or to not do that. God has given you free will, but in his love, he invites people just like you and me, men and women, boys and girls, great and small, popular and unpopular, skillful and not skilled. Everybody, he calls everyone to say no to our lesser plans and yes to his greater plans. And I wonder how many times in your life has Jesus come to you, has initiated contact with you and spoken to you, whether through his word or in a sermon or through a conversation with a trusted friend or a spouse or through an experience in your life, and he's disrupting things and he's trying to capture your attention, and he wants to offer you a different perspective or a different possibility or a new way, and yet you said no to him. We always think our plans are better, don't we? And so it always takes faith to say yes. I almost said even in the small things, but I wonder if it's not just especially in the small things. You know, when we have children who are sick and we are feeling desperate and we're in a panic, it's real easy to look to Jesus and say yes to what Jesus is saying to us in that moment. But what about in the small things? Or the hard things? What about when you're tired or not feeling well, or you've tried and you've tried and you've been banging your head against the wall, or the doors keep closing, whatever the circumstances that you keep, you're going through the futility of repetition, and Jesus says, do it again, and you're starting to say no. And Jesus says, say yes to me. Say yes. It takes a whole lot of faith in that point, doesn't it? Despite his reluctance and his offense and his own better judgment, you can detect, yes, resistance at first in the mind and the heart of Simon, but then also the first faint dawnings of faith. And you can feel this battle, this competition waging war in his mind and his heart, this divided heart that is listening, yes, to the voice of the professional fisherman who knows how to fish, but also you hear the voice of this fledgling disciple, potential disciple, who wants to believe. Even though it's hard, even though it goes against his better judgment, even though Jesus has done nothing but presume and offend at this point, yes, he healed, but that was his mother-in-law. Yeah, I wonder if Peter or Simon was kind of like, did you really have to heal? No, I'm just kidding. That's just a joke for all you wonderful mother-in-laws out there. You're wonderful and you're loved. You know Simon wanted Jesus to heal her. But you know his, look again in verse 5, talking about this conflict, this wrestling that's going on. Master, we worked hard all last night. We didn't catch a thing, but. You know, Pastor Bill once preached a sermon that was one of those, like, in my, long before either of us ever met any of you. This is way back when I was still in college. And it was on Philippians chapter 2. In that sermon, I can honestly say, of all the sermons I've ever heard, it was the one that changed my life the most. And one of the things he talked about is how so often we have this tendency to say yes to Jesus, and then we say but. But this, but that. Yes, Jesus, but this, but that. This is the opposite. This is Simon saying no, but if you say so, yes. And I wonder, what do you think the Lord prefers? Does he want your eager and enthusiastic and instant yes, but then with all the reasons why no? Or does he want to come right into the middle of your doubt and your indecision and your hesitation and find, yes, there's a battle, yes, you're wrestling, you're having a hard time saying yes, but you'll do it anyway? Which do you think the Lord prefers? Which do you think is a clearer picture of faith? Master, we've been out all night. We haven't caught a thing. I know how to fish. I know what is best. I know what I'm talking about. You're a carpenter, for crying out loud. But I'll do it if you tell me to. I'll do it. And friends, that's what gives this story legs. That's what enables this chiasm to progress to the next stage. That's what allows it to move from what precedes the moment to the moment. Simon's decision at every critical crisis point is a yes to Jesus. And that is always the starting place of any true Christian discipleship. It's when we say yes to Jesus, yes to his ways, yes to his perspective, yes to his commands, when we accept his word over our lives, despite our better judgment, despite our own logic and reason, despite our own experience, when we say yes to Jesus. But listen, that is also what always sustains progression in discipleship. It's not just this one time, yes, I came to an altar, I admitted that I was a sinner, fill in the blank of the things that happen here, and we say yes to him, but then we rise, and then what? It's not just one yes, it's a series of yeses. It's a yes in every moment of life. That is what sustains progression in discipleship. It's what gives your life in Christ legs. It's how it moves, is faith and trust and obedience in the Lord's word, moment after moment after moment in all of life. And how often have we said yes to this and yes to that, but no here? I'll give this to you, Jesus. I'll give this part of my heart to you. I'll give this relationship, this need, this petition, but you ask for this? Uh-uh. It's one thing to give him the boat. It's another thing to put down the net. And Simon, in his faith, however big or small, pure or polluted it was, in his faith, he said yes. He said no, but then he said yes. Yes, yes, yes. There was Peter going through the motions of life before Jesus. Work, eat, sleep, repeat. Work, eat, sleep, repeat. The same monotonous routine that every single person in here knows exactly what I'm talking about. You wake up at the same time. You eat your same breakfast every morning. It's two Eggo waffles with log cabin syrup on top. And by the way, I don't even use a fork anymore because it's quicker. Just grab it and eat it and go. You go to work. You go to school. You go to the Y. You do the same thing on this day. The next week on the same day, you're doing the same thing. You come home to the same person or the lack of people. You watch the same programs on TV. You do the same things over and over and over and over until you die. And here Jesus comes right in the middle of the routine, and he flips the script on Simon. And he turns what is mundane and monotonous into the miraculous. He transforms something that has temporal value that won't be remembered beyond the moment, and he gives it something with eternal significance. He takes what is empty and lifeless and fruitless, and he fills it to the overflowing of his abundance. His plans, church, and I implore you to accept this by faith, his plans for your life and for my life are always better than our own. There's never a moment, there's never a decision, there's never a circumstance where your own judgment or how you think it should go is somehow better than God's. It's never that way. Even though most of the time his perspective and his way seems ridiculous to you, it's always better every time. And faith alone, faith is what brings those plans that he has in his mind and heart for you into reality. It's how they come into fruition. It's how they materialize and go from what's in the mind of God, the heart of God, into your own life. It is faith. The question is, are you trusting his greater plans and purposes in every arena of your life? Or is there some secret place, some little compartment, where you said, yes, Jesus, but this is mine. I trust your plans for those people. And you're good at telling people that too. Hey, you need to trust Jesus. And you're all the while trying to like hide this thing. Don't worry about what's in here. You're like the Wizard of Oz. Don't worry about what's behind the curtain, what's behind the coat. Just ignore that. Listen to my voice. Are you trusting his plans and his purposes and his perspective on everything in your life? Every situation, every relationship, every hurt, every success, every challenge. Do you have the faith, even if it's just a little, to say yes to him in all of it? Now, the greater miracle, in my opinion, in this text, and I didn't have time to read, you know, all the commentaries out there. I have a trusted few that I look at when I'm preparing from week to week, and none of them made any comments about this. So this is just the pastor's opinion, or maybe this is something the Spirit laid on my heart that's unique. I don't know. But for me, the greater miracle in our text here, it's not the catch of fish. Now, I know there's some fishermen in the congregation this morning. I'm sure there's some tuning in on our live stream. You can relate to me when I tell you that I, in my experience, have been on some bad fishing trips. I'm talking bad fishing trips. And I hate to say it, but I think the majority of them were with my dad. Now, the trip themselves, I mean, the social time, the relational time with my dad is always, I mean, great. And I miss my dad, and I love nothing more than to hop on a boat with dad and go not catch fish somewhere. And there were times where we had some success. We had trips up to Lake Erie and up into Canada and trips down to Florida, and we hit all the lakes around central Ohio and the Ohio River. Kentucky, West Virginia, we've been all around sort of that area of the Midwest, and, you know, we had some successes, but, oh, man, did we have some failures. I'm talking just countless hours. And, you know, as a teenager, you know, when you think you've got better things to do than spend time with your dad, you know, I'm like, oh, I just want to go home. You teenagers, by the way, have some perspective. This is not in the sermon. Cherish the time with your parents. But yeah, we had some bad fishing trips. You know, troubles loading the boat in and out of the water. I'll never forget the time we were backing the boat in and the ramp had the grimy green stuff all over it. And as the truck stopped and the boat was supposed to go, the truck just kept going. And I was like, like I was picturing everything going into the water. It was terrifying. We always had some issue with the boat. Casting lures into trees that are like, you couldn't shoot a rifle that far. But somehow we managed to throw a rattle trap into like 20 feet up into that tree. You're never going to see it again. So now you're like trying to just break the line to get your, you know, whatever. Over, I mean, just fill in the blank. If it could happen on the water, it happened to us. And listen, there were times where it felt like catching any fish. I mean, I'll take a minnow at this point. Anything is would feel like a miracle. And nothing like this ever happened to us. We never had so much fish that the boat is starting to sink. I mean, that's exactly what he says here. I mean, look again there in verse 6. Their nets were so full of fish, and these nets are, you know, they're weighted so that the bottom of the net would drop to the bottom of the sea, and then it formed like a wall. And in the wall were a series of layers of nets that fish would go through and get trapped in. And they put this net down, and they pulled up, and there were so many fish in that the net itself was starting to tear. And you can see the men laboring just to get the haul in. And then they called the other boat, come over and help us out. We've struck gold here. What is happening? And they're filling more fish and more fish until both boats are so full. I mean, there's a 20 to 30 foot boat. I mean, these are not little, you know, little John boats like what I've spent a lot of time on. These are big boats built for this purpose. And yet they are overwhelmed to the point of being about to be sunk to the bottom of the sea. I never had anything like that happen in my life. It's miraculous, without a doubt. But as miraculous as this catch in and of itself was, the greater miracle, in my opinion, the greater miracle here was in the catch's ability and power to reveal. To reveal. If a miracle is an event that cannot be explained by, you know, natural or scientific laws and is therefore considered, you know, an act of divine agency, well then every revelatory event in history is miraculous. You cannot explain revelation. Revelation is not human beings using their own intellect and intuition to discern things that are of a different order or magnitude of ourselves or a different, you know, plane of existence. That's not revelation. Revelation is when that comes to us. When what is above comes to us and speaks about itself in our categories and in ways that we can understand and grasp and appreciate and respond to. That's miraculous. And Simon did not intuit out of his own wisdom or his own intelligence the identity of Jesus. It, in this moment, was revealed to him. A truth from heaven was exposed to him. And his eyes, which were physically taking in this moment, his eyes were open, but so were the eyes of his heart. his spiritual eyes. The scales fell off. And Jesus came to Simon and acted in such a way that to Simon it can only mean one thing. Other people may dismiss what happened. Other people may look at it and say, well, it was coincidence, it was just luck. Or maybe it was some sort of like, you know, scheme that Jesus had, you know, prepared in advance. You know, there's all sorts of skeptics that can take the miraculous in our lives and twist it to mean something else or to be less than what it really is. But Simon knew exactly what it was. Jesus came and revealed himself to him in that moment in such a way that there was no doubt in his mind. He's more than just a good rabbi. He's more than just a good teacher. He's more even than the master. He's referred to him back in verse 5, which, by the way, means boss man. Joe Davis, you call me boss man whenever you see me. I know that's an expression of, you know, respect or whatever, but I know at the end of the day that I am not your boss whatsoever. Master, boss man, I'll do what you say. No, he's more than rabbi, more than teacher, more than master. He is the Lord. And he says as much in his response. When Simon Peter realized what had happened, he fell to his knees before Jesus and said, "Oh Lord, please leave me. Please leave me. I am so sinful." And his response here is a dead giveaway to not only the identity of who Jesus is, but to the awareness that Simon had of that. Because that's how every person, no matter who they are in all of history, that's how every person feels when they've had a genuine encounter with the Holy One. His holiness exposes our unholiness. And if you think Simon felt on the spot when Jesus stepped onto his boat and all the people started looking at him, that he would trade that every single time in exchange for what he has here. For the eyes of the Holy One are piercing right into his heart. Just like Isaiah in chapter 6. Remember Isaiah 6? In the year King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up. He was in the temple. The hem of his garment is so grand that it filled the temple, and there's smoke and there's lightning and there's holy beings and all this stuff is happening. And Isaiah says what? Woe is me. I'm toast. I don't stand to last a millisecond in the presence of the Holy One because I'm a man of unclean lips and I come from a people of unclean lips. And we see the exact same thing right here with Simon. I'm toast. He's just revealed to me who he is. I don't stand a chance. Depart from me. If you know what's under the water, you know what's inside of my heart. And just like every other person who's ever been exposed like this from the inside out, his mind and heart were flooded with fear and shame and embarrassment and unworthiness. But listen here, church. Jesus' response to him in this moment tells more to us about Jesus' own heart and Jesus' own character and Jesus' own person than if they had pulled up enough fish to fill 1,000 boats. Don't miss the reply of the Lord in this moment. Listen, when I first heard Jesus say this to me, I'll never forget it. I was in college. A lot happened in my life in college, in case you haven't learned. For the first time in my life, Jesus spoke these words. It was through this text, by the way. Spoke this text to my heart. When I was crushed in my sin, I was exposed. I knew I was unworthy. I knew I was dirty. I knew that there's no way a holy God could love me or want me or accept me or ever have any plan for my life. There's no way. There's no way he wants me. He's disgusted with my life. He doesn't want anything to do with me. He's ready to get rid of me. And Jesus comes and he said to me what he said to Simon and what he says to you, do not fear. Do not fear. I'm not here to punish you. I'm not here to ridicule you. I'm not here to terrorize you. I want you to know who I am. And I want you to trust me. And I want you to follow me. Simon, I'm not here to commandeer your boat. I'm here to commandeer you. And this catch that you see, oh, it's wonderful. There's plenty more under there, I promise. But this catch is just a drop in the sea compared to the greater things that I have in store for your life. Is Jesus anything more to you today than just the boss man? You know, the guy whose authority you sort of vaguely acknowledge. You have some sort of a, you know, sort of a superficial, you know, surface level commitment to him. The kind of boss man where you obey the orders in public when all the eyes are looking at you. You know, you get the pressure of your peers or your church, and you got to make sure everyone sees that you're the good Christian person, right? You obey the boss man. See, the boss man that you listen to because you don't really have a choice. Or you just go through all the motions of doing all the stuff because after all, you kind of owe him. He did do something for you, right? You know, Simon felt this obligation. My goodness, you healed my mother-in-law. I guess, sure, you can use my boat. And if you tell me to go out, I'll throw this very superficial level of connection. Listen, you and I do have obligation to Jesus. He's done more for your life and for my life than any of us could ever fully know or comprehend or appreciate. And he is the boss. He is in charge. And we do owe a certain duty to him. And some of that duty even involves carrying out that duty within in the public arena, in the sight of others. And there's an appropriate way of doing that and thinking about that. Yes, we are to live out our faith in Paul in Ephesians, before the world or in the sight of the world. There's a public dimension to our duty to serve the boss man. But listen, he wants to be so much more than that for you. He wants to be the Lord. The one who takes all of your fear. Every bit of it. Not just, afraid, to drive at night on, the 4th of July. When all the crazy drunk people are out there driving, right? Not just fear, that the stock market's going to crash. I mean, all your fear. Most importantly, your fear that God won't accept you, or that God is disgusted with you, or that you are meaningless to him, you have no value to him, he has no purpose for your life. Even those kinds of fears, those big fears, he wants to take all of that fear as the Lord and displace it with his peace. My peace, Jesus says, I give to you in a way the world can never give to you. You can have a peace that passes all understanding. He wants to be the Lord who takes your futility and replace it with purpose. He wants to flip the script of your life so that his greater plans for you can be manifest, brought into reality. There are no empty nets with Jesus when we respond to his approach and his invitation and his command with even the tiniest bit of faith. For all his mistakes and all of his blunders, Simon Peter shows us the right response to the call of Jesus. And even though Jesus commands the crazy and the impossible, in the end, Peter says yes. And one of the things that we find here is that Peter's humility and his self-awareness in the presence of the Lord do not somehow disqualify him from being a disciple. No, they are the prerequisites to being a disciple. And every one of us in here has to come to this moment where we acknowledge, yes, the holiness and the greatness and the divinity and the lordship of Christ. We also have to acknowledge what that means for me, my own puniness, my own sinfulness. in the depths of it and how it has wreaked havoc on every aspect of who I am. We believe in the total depravity of man. Sin has ravaged who we are from top to bottom. And we have to acknowledge that before God, and it should drive us to our knees. And that is the prerequisite for faith and trust and obedience and discipleship. That's the starting point. And the only way to truly follow Jesus is not just purely out of duty. No, it's in our weakness, it's out of our emptiness, it's out of humility, and it's with all of our totality. You know, when Matthew and Mark tell this story, they emphasize how the fishermen here in the story, when they get back, they leave their boats and they leave their father, their parents, their family behind. And that, I'm not diminishing that whatsoever. It's the emphasis there in their gospels. It's powerful, and I hope it speaks to your life and to my life, that they left their job, they left their families, they forsook their old means of provision, their sources of their identity, their familial ties, all that stuff. But Luke's emphasis is not only more simple than that, it is more holistic than that. Luke's emphasis is on the everythingness of following Jesus. The only right response to his claim on a person's life can be found right here in verse 11. Look at it again with me. Don't just listen to me. I want you to look at it if you have it open. And as soon as they landed, notice the time component. Again, not trivial, is it? It's not just a detail that's thrown in there for the sake of telling a good story. No. As soon as they landed, the second they got back, they didn't waste another moment. They left everything. They left everything, and they followed Jesus. I know the times are different from then till now. I know the culture is different. I know the characters in the story are different. But listen, I believe that Jesus' desire and call and invitation and expectation for us is the same. No, you are not the next Apostle Peter. And we all know I'm not either. None of us are the Rock, Peter the Rock. This is a once in the Bible type of figure. I get that. But he still sees you. Listen, Peter was nothing great. Peter was just a guy on the sidelines. Are you just on the sidelines? Jesus sees you. He notices you. No matter how distant you are from God, no matter how ordinary you are or feel you are, no matter how marginal you've become, others have taken a central position in the plot of your life and you've been pushed to the sides, no matter how much of a nobody you might be, he takes notice of you. And he's closer to you than you think. And when you turn and look at his gaze with the eyes of faith, he's staring right back already. And he looks into empty, hopeless, dead-end situations, and he sees all new possibilities. And listen, it doesn't matter to me how fast you can run. Some of you are faster than others. I used to be fast, believe it or not. I'm not anymore. No matter how fast you can run, I promise you this, you can't beat Jesus in a foot race to a reconciled relationship. He'll beat you to that every time. He's always a step ahead. Maybe you've just been living like the crowds here in the story. You know, the crowds, you almost forget they're even there, don't you? They're just spectators. They're forgettable. You don't know a single name. In this story, they're almost just filler material. I hate to say that because it's not, but it feels that way. They're an afterthought. And that's all Peter, listen, that's all Peter would have ever been himself if he had decided that he was too tired for Jesus or too busy for Jesus, or, you know, Jesus had nothing, no value to add to his life. Jesus wasn't worth listening to. Peter would have been just another face in the crowd. And guess what? In the great span of human history, you and I are just a blip on the radar, if that. Our lives are so short. So few people will ever remember we ever lived. And our lives this whatever span of time that God gives us will be just an afterthought apart from him. But when you open up to him, when you say yes to him, oh, Jesus is in the business of taking what is mundane and monotonous and turning it into the miraculous. Who's the real fisherman in the story here? It's not Peter. He's just a guy trying to catch fish. No, the real fisherman is Jesus. He's the one who desires to haul in people like you, people like me. He approaches us that he might appropriate us, to take what is common, to use it for the extraordinary. I want you to hear his voice this morning as he calls you, as he fixes his gaze on you, as he laser locked on your face, on your life, on your circumstances, as he comes to you and approaches you. Listen, he's calling you to a life of more than just hauling up empty nets. He wants to catch you in his nets of love and to draw you into the boat or the ark of his salvation, a life of reconciliation with God. Listen, to be a Christian, there's no such thing as a Christian who is not a disciple. To be a Christian is to be a disciple. It's the very definition. To follow Jesus, to be a disciple, means to have the faith and the trust to follow Jesus, to leave it all behind, no matter what it costs. Are you willing to be a church filled full of that kind of disciple today? Hear his voice. See his gaze, hear his invitation. He's on approach. He's asking you to give it all up for him. And I promise you, his plans are greater than your own. Let us pray. Lord, I thank you. I'm almost embarrassed that the church gets to hear me pray this because I feel this is so personal, but I just thank you for the truth of this passage and how it has brought so much to my own life. How you took a young man who wanted to serve you, wanted to follow you, wanted to obey you, but was just captured in sin and bad thinking and bad theology and stuck in a rut, feeling hopeless and pathetic and unworthy. And you and all your beauty said, do not be afraid. Lord, would you speak to your church today in the exact same way? In all of our rebellion and futility, all of our dirtiness. And we know that the one who sees beneath the waves is the same one who walks on the waves, is the same one that created the waves. And you know the waves in our heart, our hearts that are so often divided and torn between our way and your way. Lord, would you come and speak peace and life and lift our bowed heads up to behold beauty of your grace and your mercy and your marvelous person. Lord, speak to your church today, and may we respond as Simon responded. Maybe it's a no at first, but maybe it'd be followed with a yes. Maybe we'd be willing to step out and trust you a little bit more today than before. Maybe we'd be willing to say no to ourselves, perhaps for the first time in our lives, and say yes to you. We don't know what it means, and it's scary, and it doesn't even make any sense, but we hear you tugging at our hearts, and we know it's right. Lord, give us the strength to say yes to you today, and this afternoon, and tonight, and tomorrow, and every day for the rest of our lives, because your plans are always better than our own. Lord, we lift these prayers to you in faith. in your precious and powerful and holy name. Amen.